Right. So I'm going to go ahead and start. So first of all, I wanted to say hello to everyone and welcome to today's online seminar hosted by the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. I'm Dr. Sarah Camacho-Felix, and I'm an assistant professorial lecturer, and I'm also the program lead for the Atlantic Fellows in Social and Economic Equity Program, which is housed at the International Inequalities Institute. I'm really pleased to be chairing today's seminar titled "Does Dual Citizenship Reproduce Inequalities?" This is part of the III's Inequality seminar series. And today's speaker is Robtel Nijhe-Paley. Dr. Paley is an assistant professor in international social and public policy. She joined the LSE's Department of Social Policy in September of 2020, and she contributes to a range of undergraduate and postgraduate courses. A Liberian scholar activist working at the intersections of critical development studies, critical African studies, and critical race studies, Robtel centers her research around how structural transformation is conceived and contested by local, national, and transnational actors from crisis-affected regions of the so-called Global South. As this event is in a Zoom meeting rather than a webinar format, we can see each other in the audience and when we can be a bit more interactive. I just ask that you please keep yourself muted while Robtel is speaking. As usual, there will be a chance for you to pose questions to Robtel following the presentation. Please do so by using the raise hand function to ask your question directly. Or if for whatever reason you prefer, you can also post the question in the chat, but make sure to state your name and affiliation in both cases. Just a quick mention of upcoming events at the III. The next inequalities seminar series is titled, Is there a grand gender convergence in 21st century Canada? The jury is still out. And it's gonna take place next Tuesday, the 7th of December, from 12:30 to 1:30 p.m. The link to the event, along with more upcoming events, can be found in the chat. And so without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Dr. Paley, and welcome.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for that very, very generous introduction. I would like to thank the III for enabling me to present my book in this format, and to also thank Abra, who's in the background doing all the heavy lifting, but definitely wanted to acknowledge her and to shout her out. So without much ado, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen so that you can see my slides. So the question that I'm posing today is, does dual citizenship reproduce inequalities? And that's a question that I'm posing to you. Hopefully we can answer this question during the course of the Q&A. So in terms of the outline of the presentation, I'm going to talk about the major arguments that my book makes, Development, Dual Citizenship, and Its Discontents, the Political Economy of Belonging to Liberia. In part two, I want to focus on what kinds of contributions I'm putting forward, not only theoretical, but also methodological as well as empirical. And then in part three, I want to talk about what are the implications of this book and its findings for policy making and practice in Liberia, but also across the continent and across the globe more broadly. So let's begin with the major arguments. So the book is a case study of Liberia. And what's interesting about Liberia is that it was Africa's first Black African Republic. And as a result, it was really the first country in the continent to devise legal norms around citizenship, around membership, around belonging. So as a starting point, you've got a unique case study as an entry. This is also the first book that investigates not only domestic, but also diasporic constructions and practices of Liberian citizenship across space and time and their myriad implications for development. Now, I'm very clear in this book that when I speak about development, I'm not talking about the sort of single-minded pursuit of economic growth or GDP growth. I'm certainly also not talking about the sort of privileging of Western whiteness and modernity, which happens to be very, very much embedded in the mainstream discourses around development. What I mean by development is effectively how do people's experiences of poverty, experiences of power, experiences of privilege, how are they mediated across space and time, right? And what I do is I use a contested dual citizenship bill introduced in Liberia in 2008, suspended for about a decade to ask broader questions about what does it mean to be a citizen in a post-war context? And what does that mean for practices of development and engagement with development? So what are my major arguments? One of the arguments that I make is that while mid-19th century to mid-20th century Liberian citizenship was largely passive and constructed from above by what we might call a hegemonic state, mid-20th century Liberian citizenship onward has been largely active and reconstructed from below through processes of protest and contestations by citizens themselves. Now, why is that? Because there are contemporary as well as historical factors that have contributed to this sort of contestations around citizenship. And those factors are conflict, migration, and post-war recovery. So within the context of migration, what's interesting is that while Liberia was considered a country of relative immigration, IMMI, in the 19th century when the country was established as Africa's first Black Republic, citizenship laws and norms were biased against what I call the rooted indigen. So those indigenous populations that lived on the coast of what was then Liberia, independent Liberia, but also in the hinterland, those indigenous populations were barred from citizenship for the first 100 years of the country's establishment as Africa's first Black Republic. And the people who barred them from citizenship were migrants, Black transatlantic migrants who came from the United States, who came from the Congo River Basin, and then also who came from the Caribbean, barred from citizenship, these indigenous groups. Interestingly enough, in the 21st century, Liberia is considered a country of relative emigration, EMI. However, citizenship laws and norms are biased against what I call the rootless emigrant. So those Liberians who may have left before, during, or after the protracted armed conflict of 1989 to 2003 are barred from citizenship. Now, what's interesting is that there is a caveat in that barring of citizenship of what we might call the rootless immigrant. Liberians who are born or brought to Liberian citizen fathers are able to retain their Liberian citizenship by ancestry, but they must declare at the age of majority, effectively the age of 21, whether they want to maintain their Liberian citizenship by ancestry or their foreign citizenship by birth. So there's somewhat of a conditional dual citizenship embedded in our aliens and nationality law, as well as our constitution of 1986, but it's only for those Liberians born abroad to Liberian citizen fathers. And I'll talk about the gender dimensions of Liberia's citizenship laws in the next couple of slides. Now, why is there so much contestation around citizenship from the establishment of the nation state in 1847 until now? Interestingly enough, a number of scholars, including Bronwyn Mambi, who's based here at the LSE, as well as Mahmoud Mamdani, who talks quite extensively about citizenship laws and norms and the political subjectivity within the continent of Africa, they have argued that citizenship is viscerally contested in African countries that have experienced the greatest colonial era migration. And although Liberia was not formally colonized by European powers, it did experience vast waves of transatlantic Black migrants coming to the continent in the 19th and 20th centuries. The second argument that I make is that the sort of 21st century impasse or gridlock on dual citizenship, again, lingered. This bill that was introduced in 2008 lingered in legislative limbo for 10 years and was never passed. So this 21st century impasse or gridlock on dual citizenship is really emblematic of the struggles over citizenship, Liberian citizenship, that is, across space and time. What's interesting is that Liberia is one of seven countries, somewhat of an outlier in the continent, that strictly prohibits dual citizenship, except for those conditional dual citizens who must declare at the age of majority whether they want to maintain their Liberian citizenship by ancestry. The other countries are Cameroon, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Tanzania. In the book, I speculate as to why these specific countries prohibit dual citizenship. And if you're interested in that, we can have a conversation during the Q&A. The last argument that I make is that domestic as well as diasporic actors, Liberian actors that is, interpret citizenship and dual citizenship quite differently based on what development sociologist Norman Long calls their life worlds, which is effectively their lived experiences, as well as their social locations, so their socioeconomic status. What I found is during the interviews that I conducted in five different countries, five different cities across three different continents, and I'll talk about that during the methodological contribution slide, is that domestic Liberians generally view dual citizenship as a zero-sum game. They see dual citizenship as privileging an already privileged class of transnational actors and as reproducing economic inequalities in the country. On the other hand, many diasporic Liberians, now they're not a monolithic particular field, but many diasporic Liberians that I interviewed argue that dual citizenship would enhance development by entrenching their political, economic, social contributions to post-war recovery in the country. So you can already see a very clearly defined polarized debates between the diasporic aspirations and the domestic aspirations. And this is interestingly emblematic of the two quotes that I've posted here in this particular slide. So I talk about how the proposed bill reveals both diasporic aspirations, but then also domestic anxieties. Now I interviewed two sponsors of the bill. Actually, I interviewed four sponsors of the bill, but the two sponsors that I have highlighted throughout these quotes are summarizing the sort of polarized debate. So Cletus Waterson is a former senator. He was a chief sponsor of the 2008 DC bill, and he reveals a sort of domestic anxieties or the diasporic aspirations around dual citizenship. So he says a lot of them, and he's meaning Liberians abroad, had to change their lifestyle, accept the dictates from a strange country for survival. He's speaking specifically about those who left during the course of the armed conflict. In some countries, it meant you had to become a citizen of that country to enjoy certain benefits. But in taking that involuntary stance, it qualified them for disqualification of their citizenships in their own country, which I believe is unfair. If you look at the polar opposite argument as espoused by Jewel Howard Taylor, who is the current vice president of Liberia, she was a former senator at the time when I interviewed her in 2013, also a sponsor of the 2008 dual citizenship bill. And she says, Liberians here, a lot of them are not working. They're unemployed and they feel as if Liberians coming from the diaspora who have had all of these opportunities want to come and take their space. Again, entrenching specifically political and economic inequalities in the country if dual citizenship is enacted in Liberia is the sort of anxiety or angst that domestic actors might have about viewing this book, this bill. What's interesting about the dual citizenship bill is that it explicitly addresses gendered inequalities within Liberia's 1973 Aliens and Nationality Law, as well as in its 1986 Constitution. So citizenship is entrenchedly differentiated by gender in Liberia. I mentioned in the first couple of slides that Liberian citizen mothers cannot pass on citizenship to their children born abroad, although Liberian citizen fathers can. So you can understand the sort of discriminatory underpinnings of this particular law. The bill attempts or purports to remove that restriction within the Aliens and Nationality Law. However, what's interesting to me is that the bill is effectively very silent on how Liberian citizenship is differentiated by race. Now, the new project I'm working on focuses on Liberia's Negro Clause. It was a clause embedded in both the Aliens and Nationality Law when it was established in 1973, but also the 1847 Constitution that effectively states people of non-African, non-Negro, non-Blacks cannot obtain citizenship by birth and naturalization. This particular provision was instituted in 1847 because those who came to Liberia, to the continent of Africa at the time, were fleeing gross economic injustice and racial inequalities in the United States as well as in the Caribbean. And so they embedded this clause in order to protect their ability to control the means of production in the country. And this is a law that endures even in the 21st century. So what's interesting is that the bill doesn't address the differentiated citizenship by race because there's such a visceral response to abrogating this particular provision in the Aliens and Nationality Law and then 1946 Constitution. So I've pulled up two quotes from my interviews, one from someone who's based in Monrovia and one from someone who's based in London, to demonstrate that people across the board, both domestic as well as diasporic Liberians, have very serious anxieties around abrogating this particular provision within the Aliens and Nationality Law and Constitution. So one person says, I believe, and this is a Liberian entrepreneur, 53-year-old man based in Monrovia. He says, I believe Liberians are a very long way from gaining control of their economy, which I believe is fundamental to our stability and peace. And until deliberate efforts are made by not just this, he means the Ellen Johnson Sirleaf administration, any government for that matter, to see Liberians take full control, meaningful control of their economy, I think it would be premature to have foreigners become citizens of Liberia. Foreigners meaning people of non-Negro descent. The other interview I've pulled is from a 31-year-old male based in London, and he says, if we remove this Negro clause, they, non-Blacks, will buy up every lick of the private sector. There's a whole bunch of landowners in Monrovia who will be eager to sell because they will see six zeros and their eyeballs will start turning, and Liberia won't be Liberian anymore. It won't. That's why I'm in favor of the Negro clause. And if that makes me a bigot or pseudo-racist or prejudiced, then yeah, I am. When he speaks about non-Blacks, what he's specifically referring to is Lebanese, Syrian, Indian entrepreneurs, migrant entrepreneurs, some of whom have lived in Liberia for generations. And the sort of threat that a lot of Liberians feel is that removing the clause will again reproduce economic inequalities by giving these entrepreneurs a foothold in the economy that even Liberians cannot control and do not control themselves. So I'm going to move on to my contributions. So the book, as demonstrated in some of these quotes, presents a critical framing of citizenship, not only as a continuum of both inclusion and exclusion, legibility or illegibility, but the fact that citizenship is very multi-layered, that it's differentiated around these social qualifiers, such as race, such as gender, such as ethnicity, such as class, so forth and so on. But I also present development. I present a critical framing of development as both a process of amelioration, again, of betterment, broader processes of political, economic, social transformation or change, but also as a process of degeneration, depending on your particular positionality. So your life world or your social location, as indicated by Norman Long. I also interrogate the sort of presumed symbiotic relationship between development and dual citizenship that happens to be very pervasive in the policy discourse. So the idea is that dual citizenship leads to development or development leads to dual citizenship. And there's some sort of symbiotic relationship between the two. What I demonstrate is that dual citizenship as a development prescription or policy intervention is viscerally contested. So in doing this, I present the sort of critiques in the scholarly literature around dual citizenship. A number of scholars have demonstrated that dual citizenship is simply about extending rights without necessarily extracting responsibilities, that it doesn't really require anything of those who might be dual citizens. It doesn't require that they pay taxes. It doesn't require that they abide by the laws of the state. It doesn't require anything. It's the sort of something one of the scholars have demonstrated. It's really about citizenship a la carte. It gives a menu of options to different people, but doesn't necessarily extract anything from them in terms of responsibilities. A number of other scholars have said that there's no real correlation, no empirical correlation between enacting dual citizenship in a particular nation state and the increased economic contributions of those nationals who might be dual citizens, who might live abroad as transnational actors, right? So the sort of interrogation of the symbiotic relationship is something that I bring forward in my analysis. I also center the perspectives of domestic citizens as much as I do diasporic citizens, right? And their practices is effectively very key to socioeconomic transformation. And in doing this, I challenge the literature that tends to privilege the citizenship claims of immigrants almost solely and wholly. The other thing that I do in the book is I offer a sort of post-colonial critique of this sort of neoliberal framing of diasporas and donors as the panacea to post-war reconstruction, as the solution to post-war reconstruction, effectively rolling back the state in order to entrench the perspectives of diasporas as well as donors. So what I demonstrate is that diaspora citizenship as well as development claims are as contested as donors' development claims. And the diasporas are both a development enabler, but they're also development spoilers. And then lastly, diasporas can be a silver lining, but they're certainly not a silver bullet, especially in post-war contexts like Liberia, in which armed conflict is based on certain levels of inequalities, right? So there's a chapter titled the dichotomy of diasporic developmentalism. And what I do in this chapter is I demonstrate how diasporas, Liberian diasporas, have both helped as well as hindered post-war reconstruction through their public sector productivity, but then also through their post-war profiteering. So I document the number of graft cases that have come to the fore in the past 10, 15 years, implicating Liberians who've come from abroad, implicating Liberians who've worked in both the private sector as well as the public sector. And there's a term that I coined in the book called Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's diaspocracy. So Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was Africa's first elected woman head of state, Liberia's first elected woman head of state. She served between 2006 and 2018. And during the course of her 12-year administration, she recruited, actively recruited a number of Liberians from abroad, from Europe, from the United States, from other parts of the sub-region in West Africa, and placed them in very lucrative, influential positions in the public sector. So ministers of finance were diasporas, transnational actors, ministers of foreign affairs, people who led the state-owned enterprises, such as the Liberian Airport Authority, such as the Liberian Maritime Authority. So this sort of outsized influence of diasporas or attorneys in the managing of the affairs of the state is what I call a diasporacy. And this created quite a bit of backlash against the prospects of dual citizenship as, again, entrenching these levels of hierarchies and power imbalances between those coming from abroad, transnational actors, and those who were more domestically rooted. What happened during the diasporacy of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is that it reproduced the sort of international system of unequal pay in which diasporas or transnational actors were paid significantly more than the public sector than those who might be considered local workers, right? So there's almost a parallel between a sort of diasporic hegemony that comes out of this diasporacy and an expat hegemony through the international system of unequal pay. So you find that a number of institutions, whether they be international financial institutions such as the World Bank or the IMF, or even multilateral institutions such as the UN, tend to pay so-called expat workers, foreign workers, significantly more than local workers. And Ellen Johnson Sirleaf adopted this system in order to attract Liberians from abroad to come and work in the public sector. Again, entrenching levels of unequal pay, entrenching levels of economic inequality between these different spheres of Liberians working in the public sector. And so people view dual citizenship as effectively reproducing or the potential to reproduce these kinds of economic inequalities. So I want to move on to my theoretical contribution. So what I do in the book is I employ and I expand Norman Long's notion of actor-oriented analysis. And actor-oriented analysis effectively states that different actors respond to development interventions or even policy prescriptions, for example, such as dual citizenship, very differently, again, based on their life worlds and their social locations. But he says that it's important for us not to assume that seemingly marginalized actors, for instance, domestic Liberian actors, do not necessarily have any agency or the knowledgeability and the capacity to respond and act, and sometimes divert the best laid plans of those who might have significantly more power. He says that there's something called the interface in which negotiations happen amongst these different actors, right? And at this interface, at this site of negotiation, there can be divergence where there's confrontation or conflict and actors are not able to reconcile each other's differences. But there can also be convergence where they are able to accommodate each other's differences and there's an agreement over a particular development intervention or policy prescription such as dual citizenship, right? But what I do in the book is I further the sort of interface analysis by moving beyond sort of localized, bounded encounters over a particular development intervention or development project to think about the interface as a transnational or an ideological exchange about the merits, the pros, but then also the demerits, the cons of dual citizenship as a proposed policy intervention related to development outcomes or development interventions. I also theorize citizenship as a triad, right? Again, thinking about multi-layered citizenship or differentiated citizenship. There are a number of scholars who talk about the fact that identities, practices, and relations between people effectively transform significantly in the aftermath of violent conflict. And Liberia's experience significant amounts of violent conflict, political upheaval since its establishment as a nation state in 1847. And those contestations were particularly visceral in the 1980s. And they've become even more visceral between 1989 and 2003 during the actual armed conflict. So what does this triad look like? I think of it as a Liberian citizenship triad in which there are three nodes. So on one node is like Liberian citizenship as identity, right? So this is largely a passive form of citizenship. So it's identity by virtue of having been born in Liberia, or identity by virtue of having ancestry in Liberia. Nothing is really required. It's about claiming rights and not necessarily fulfilling obligations or responsibilities. On one hand of the citizenship triad is Liberian citizenship as practice. And this is largely an active form of citizenship. So it's everything from paying taxes to building Liberian capacities to abiding by the laws of the nation state. So this is really about fulfilling rights, fulfilling obligations and responsibilities. And then the third node of the citizenship triad is citizenship or Liberian citizenship as a set of relationships, right? So this is largely an interactive form of citizenship that looks at the interactions between citizens and citizens themselves, but also citizen and government. And this is about relationships. So you think about identity and practices about rights. You think about practice and active citizenship as about fulfilling responsibilities. And you think about these sets of relations as about maintaining or developing relations amongst different people. The subtitle of the book is The Political Economy of Belonging. So I theorize Liberian citizenship and citizenship more broadly as a political economy of belonging. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that socioeconomic transformation, a development as we might think about it, really depends on the provision of those privileges and protections, what we might deem as rights, in exchange for the fulfillment of duties and obligations, what we might think about as responsibilities, and vice versa. So it's this interplay between rights and responsibilities is what I mean by political economy of belonging. And socioeconomic transformation depends on this interplay between these two facets of citizenship. I also theorize citizenship from the post-war African country perspective, and it's a post-war African country of emigration. In doing this, I sort of expand the contours of the general citizenship literature, which really tends to be incredibly Eurocentric and abstract. So the idea is to expand the literature so that it incorporates a case study that's not necessarily mainstream. Let's move to my methodological as well as empirical contribution. So the book is based on multi-sided field work that I conducted for about 14 months. And it's based on over 200 in-depth interviews that I conducted with Liberian actors in the capitals of Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ghana, the UK, the US. And this was largely in response to the work by Sasia Sassen, who argues that citizenship is viscerally contested in urban centers. And so I interview Liberians in the capitals of these particular countries. The book also has extensive comparative analysis between what I call homelanders, so Liberians who may or may not have left during, after, or before the armed conflict, or may have left for very short periods of time, and those who are returning, those transnational actors who are returning as diasporic public sector officials, for instance, or private sector officials. And I found that there's quite a dichotomy between how they view dual citizenship or the prospect of dual citizenship from those who might be considered returnees. I also compare and contrast the perspectives of executive members of the public sector and legislative members of the public sector. So I mentioned that I interviewed four sponsors of the dual citizenship bill who were senators in the legislature at the time. Last but certainly not least, I talk about the dichotomies between what Nicholas Van Heer calls the near diaspora. So those migrants who might reside in their subregions of origin. So you think about Liberians in Sierra Leone and Ghana, for instance, versus those who might be considered wider diasporas. So those Liberians who left to go further afield. So those Liberians, for instance, in this case study, who reside in the UK and the US, and how they have very different interpretations of citizenship and very different interpretations of dual citizenship and the prospects therein for development. So what I found out, for example, is that near diasporas who live in Ghana and Sierra Leone were mostly refugees, who didn't have the wherewithal necessarily to travel to the United States or the UK. I found that those near diasporas were very, very wedded to the idea of singular citizenship, right? So they had certain anxieties around dual citizenship because they effectively believed that it would reproduce certain levels of inequalities. But these near diasporas, interestingly enough, many of whom were refugees, did not have access to obtaining second citizenships because of their refugee status, as opposed to wider diasporas who went to the United States, who went to the UK, who did have opportunities to naturalize abroad, many of whom believe that dual citizenship, again, would enhance development outcomes in the country. So you see these sort of dichotomies between those who live in the subregion and those who don't live in the subregion. Some people might argue that because those who live in the subregion are closer to the challenges of development, are closer to the challenges of broader processes of political, economic, social change, view dual citizenship as a development disenabler. So you see the breakdown in this table of the number of interviewees I interviewed and which urban centers I interviewed them. Let's move on to the implications of my findings for policymaking and practice in Liberia. So I've shared a table in this slide of the breakdown in the different viewpoints on dual citizenship. Now, I make it very clear throughout the book that these 202 Liberian respondents that I interviewed are not representative of Liberians in the country as well as Liberians outside of the country. This is a qualitative study, and it was meant to sort of demonstrate some trends, but not to be definitively representative. What's interesting about this particular table, though, is if you look at, I've been speaking quite extensively about dichotomies and discontinuities as well as binaries, but if you look at the number of Liberians in my respondent pool who support dual citizenship, it's the vast majority of them. About 61% of my respondents view dual citizenship in principle as a development enabler. The interesting trend is looking at those who rejected dual citizenship. So about 18%, 37 Liberians I interviewed out of 202, the vast majority of whom are based in Monrovia. Again, so one of my hypotheses is that those who are based in Monrovia view dual citizenship as a disenabler because they're closer to the challenges of post-war reconstruction in the country. And the singular citizenship enables them to see those who live abroad as being effectively more privileged than they are and feeling very threatened by that privilege, whether that privilege is a seeming privilege or an actual real privilege. Now, what's interesting is that I found juxtaposed my qualitative research with survey data that came out of the Afrobarometer survey. Afrobarometer is a Pan-African survey that's sort of looks at political trends within the continent of Africa. And Afrobarometer did a survey in Liberia in 2012 as well as 2018, in which they realized that the vast majority of those surveyed, about two-thirds of Liberians, rejected dual citizenship in both 2012 and 2018, those two survey rounds. All of these Liberians, of course, were based and surveyed in the country. So for me, there's a sort of corroboration of the Afrobarometer data in my data, looking at the fact that 18% of those who rejected dual citizenship in my respondent pool, the vast majority of them were in the capital, Monrovia, as opposed to outside in diasporic hotspots. So Liberia had a referendum. And in 2020, in December 2020, and dual citizenship was one of eight propositions put forward. What the referendum results demonstrated to me, although the proposition on dual citizenship was not overwhelmingly accepted, is that dual citizenship is actually inevitable for Liberia, where the country is inching closer and closer to accepting the sort of principled stance on how dual citizenship is a development enabler. And this represents a sort of continental trends, right? So more than 75% of countries in the continent have some form of dual citizenship regulation. Some are more restrictive than others, but across the board, those seven countries that I mentioned in the beginning are outliers, right? So even in the sub-political divisions in Liberia where dual citizenship was rejected outright, so Monserrato, Bomi, Nimba, Barbalu, Grand Cru County, continental trends are still very, very much evident. Now, I've pulled the referendum results from Monserrato County. Monserrato County is a subpolitical division in Liberia where the capital, Monrovia, resides. And if you can see that, it's a bit grainy, but you can see that the vote amongst valid ballots is almost split in half, 50-50. So about 96,000 Liberians in Monserrato County supported dual citizenship in principle, and about 97,000 Liberians rejected dual citizenship. If you remember the Afrobarometer data from 2012 to 2018, the results were that 2/3 of Liberians actually rejected dual citizenship. But in this 2020 national referendum results, you see an almost even 50-50 split. So again, the continental trends are very, very evident in the results of the national referendum, because you see half of Liberians in Montserrado County actually supporting dual citizenship as opposed to those who reject dual citizenship. Liberia is inching closer and closer to the idea of possibly being or not being an outlier in that respect. However, the argument that I make is that Liberia has to take a very gradual, phased approach to legislating dual citizenship. And it's because of these contestations, particularly amongst our domestic Liberians who view dual citizenship as potentially enabling or reproducing inequalities in the country, inequalities around political participation, inequalities around economic participation, and inequalities around social cohesion or lack thereof. So one of the recommendations that I make is that Liberia has to look at how does the country reconcile the contradictions between the 1973 Aliens and Nationality Law, which effectively prohibits dual citizenship, and the 1986 Constitution coming out of the 1847 Constitution that seemingly supports dual citizenship. There's a new House bill before the Senate at the moment. The House supported the bill and decided to pass the bill forward to the Senate for concurrence. And that House bill is a bit more egalitarian in trying to reconcile these differences between the Aliens and Nationality Law and the 1986 Constitution. So we'll see what happens in the next few months as it relates to the Senate's potential concurrence of the bill. The other thing that I recommend is that Liberia has to focus on judicial reform. Many of those diasporic as well as domestic Liberians that I spoke to who were staunchly opposed to dual citizenship argue that many Liberians carry two passports, and this is definitely against the actual law, right? So if people are flouting the national laws and dual citizenship is not enacted or hasn't been legislated, imagine what will happen when it is legislated, that there will be vast amounts of judicial contestations around supporting the law or abiding by the laws of the state by those people who have two passports and have the wherewithal to escape any sort of or reproducing any sort of impunity in the country, right? The other thing that I mentioned is that Liberia has to figure out how to address inequalities that are at the crux of these kinds of contestations, inequalities around income, inequalities around land access, and then certainly inequalities around transitional justice. So there is a whole discourse around how diasporic actors during the course of the war were the ones who fueled armed conflict and supported the war from afar, right? Financed rebel factions in order to wreak havoc in the country. And those who didn't have the wherewithal to leave were left to experience the armed conflict and to experience the consequences of the armed conflict. So how does Liberia address transitional justice so that those who bear the greatest responsibility for the war, diasporic Liberians included, face the full weight of the law? Lastly, I talk about the importance of extending rights while also extracting responsibilities as reconciling some of these tensions. And there are tons of examples from the continent of Africa in which dual citizenship or seemingly close to dual citizenship legislation has tried to figure out how to extend rights to diasporic Liberians while also extracting some responsibilities from them. So for example, there's the country of Eritrea, which charges, Eritrea is one of the seven outliers that doesn't recognize dual citizenship, but they do charge something called a diaspora tax, right? And that diaspora's tax is used to help with domestic resource mobilization, is used for infrastructural development in the country. Another example is Senegal, which allows the voting for diaspora representatives in the national legislature. So instead of giving carte blanche political rights to diasporas or would-be dual citizens, how about giving them representation in the national legislature until a fully formed substantive dual citizenship bill is enacted? The other country that I mentioned in my analysis is Sierra Leone, which has established an operational office of diaspora affairs in the presidency that fields the concerns, that tries to harness the political, economic, and social potential of those to contribute to post-war reconstruction in Sierra Leone. Again, extracting responsibilities while also extending rights to those who are would-be dual citizens or who carry two passports or two nationalities. And then Ethiopia, which is one of the outliers that doesn't recognize dual citizenship, also allows non-citizen diasporas to invest in, to own shares, and then also to set up lending businesses. So the economic rights are extended without necessarily providing the political rights to vote, for instance, or to hold public office, for instance. The last example that I give is perhaps granting rights to Liberians abroad who don't necessarily have Liberian citizenship to purchase rural land in exchange for them giving some sort of agricultural production from the land. So Liberia imports most of its food. So granting rights for diasporas to own land, because land ownership and citizenship are inextricably tied in Liberia. And so if you don't have Liberian citizenship officially, you can't own land. So one of the ways of reconciling the tensions between diasporic Liberians or diasporic aspirations and domestic anxieties is perhaps extending the right to own land to those who would be dual citizens in exchange for some sort of agricultural productivity that will help with diversifying the revenue stream of the country and lessening the import cost of rice and other commodities that are consumed by citizens in the country. So I'm going to end there in terms of the analysis of the book, the contributions, but then also the implications for policy and practice. Clearly, hopefully, I've demonstrated throughout this presentation that in the context of Liberia, in the context of post-war reconstruction, as far as a number of my interlocutors are concerned, dual citizenship does reproduce inequalities. And the tall order of legislating a bill on dual citizenship in Liberia is to minimize those inequalities or to completely eliminate them. So I've put up the book purchasing information. The book is available in the LSE library if you're interested in reading it. And I'll end here by saying thank you for your attention. I look forward to the discussion that follows.
Thank you so much, Robtel. And yes, it's available in the library and in digital form. So for those of us who might not be coming into the campus, you can still access it remotely. Thank you for your presentation. I'm now going to open the floor to questions from the audience. As I said before, please use your raise of hand function to pose your question, or alternatively, you can put it in the chat stating your name and affiliation. So opening the floor. Shiku, go ahead.
Hi, Robtel. Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for that. It's really interesting. I was just trying to understand some of the rights and obligations that go with citizenship, as you've explained. So one of them is the right to ownership of property. As you said, you cannot own land, rural land, but also I didn't understand also real estate in cities. Can you own houses and things if you're not as? No. So that's clearly one fear that, as one of your interviewees said, you know, these guys from the outside who earn in dollars or pounds are just going to buy up the place. And so that's one thing. And then on taxes, you also mentioned taxes. I guess if you're a citizen or a not, so I guess taxes are about residency rather than citizenship. Is that right? Meaning if you're living in Liberia and you're, you know, you have a business or you have a salary or whatever, to the extent that the tax system captures you, which of course, you know, it's a very informal economy and all that, but if you declare and you pay taxes, it's about where you live rather than the citizenship, right? So when you say that they wouldn't be paying taxes, it's because they're earning abroad and you don't have, say, a requirement that everybody pays all of the on their worldwide income, they pay taxes in Liberia. Is that right?
So taxes is not necessarily based on residence. So they're property taxes that, I mean, I own a house in Liberia, so, and I don't live in Liberia. I mean, I do for maybe 3 months of the year, but most of the time I'm in the UK. So I still have to pay property taxes in the country, even though I'm not resident in the country.
Right, I see. So you don't pay presumably income taxes, but you pay property taxes there.
No, property taxes, yes. But what's interesting, Chico, is that this has come up as a debate within the discourse around dual citizenship. And many domestic Liberians have asked diasporic Liberians or transnational Liberians, would you be willing to go the US route, right? The US says, if you are a citizen of the United States, you're doubly taxed if you don't live in the United States. So one of the questions about the whole idea of extending rights and then extracting responsibilities, one of the questions that is often posed to diasporic Liberians is, if we legislate dual citizenship, would you be willing to pay taxes in Liberia as well as in the UK or as well as in the United States? And there's always a sort of deafening silence. So then the question becomes, well, then why should we give you the rights, the political, economic, social rights to own land, to vote in national elections, to hold public office, when you're not even considering the sort of fundamental tenet of citizenship, which is contributing through your taxes? So it has come up in the discourse around why there should or should not be dual citizenship.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. I know Arbina has her hand, but just a quick follow-up. I mean, one thing is, of course, you could negotiate tax treaties, right? Where, I mean, I think some countries have tax treaties to avoid dual taxation. But the question is, you know, will the US and these other places, you know, there's a huge asymmetry of power. Will they be prepared to say, okay, you don't need to pay taxes here if you're a Liberian? But that, I wonder if that could be almost like, a, you know, you were saying, a development debate in the sense, okay, look, you know, we don't want aid. We just want our citizens to pay tax here rather than abroad. So we want a tax agreement. I mean, the loss of tax income to the US would be minimal,
right?
But it might make a difference to Liberia. So that was one question. And then the other one, and I'll stop with that, is there ever a conversation about differentiating property taxes by residents and non-residents? Mm-hmm. That is a way of making life harder for you, Robtel, by having you pay larger property taxes than your neighbors because you don't live there. Is that ever a conversation? No.
I mean, those are really, really good questions, Chico. I think, I mean, you've given me some ideas. So full disclosure, I'm actually going to be presenting the findings of my research to the Senate in a couple of weeks. And they want to understand what does a scholarly, I mean, they actually want to understand what the scholarly literature says so that it can infuse their debates as it relates to this House bill that's been passed, because the Senate has to respond to the House bill. And one of the things that I want to bring up is this idea of taxation. So how do you operationalize a dual citizenship bill that would enable people in the country to feel so not so anxious about the potential of what this might bring in terms of reproducing inequalities? So you've just given me an idea of how the taxation might work. So maybe charging those who live abroad who have property in Liberia and have dual citizenship a little bit more. Then the follow-up question would be, how do we enforce this? Because enforceability of law and regulations, we have all the most wonderful regulations on the books. But this is one of the reasons why people feel aggrieved and concerned, is that we don't enforce anything. I mean, we don't even enforce the fact that we don't have dual citizenship. People are still carrying two passports around and they find ways to sort of evade the law. But I mean, thank you for that. Thank you for that suggestion. It doesn't exist. This isn't something that obtains now in terms of the differentiation between non-residential taxation on property and residential taxation on property. But it could be very, very well as something that the Liberia Revenue Authority institutes as a policy kind of intervention.
Thank you for that. Armina?
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Robtel. Excellent presentation. As you were speaking, I just couldn't help but think, like, this is so much like Armenia, like what you were arguing. So I guess more of a comment than I guess there's a question in that the Armenian debate is about tax, it's about voting, but it's about also as another, you know, conflict-ridden society about whose sons will serve in the army and should there be a war, fight and die, right? And so this has become an issue that if you want citizenship, then your sons between the ages of 18 to 40 need to be conscripted, or and so there is this dimension. And there's also a discussion, and you know, I was thinking about this as you were speaking, about the nationalism, the ultra-nationalism in some diaspora communities, right? Which has really hampered the peace process or ability of peace building in the country, because again, they don't, you know, they're not affected personally, right? The bombs aren't falling on them. And they're like, no, keep fighting. So just wondering, you know, about that in your context, but I love the talk and looking forward to reading the book. So thanks for sharing that.
No problem. Thank you, Amina. I mean, I don't know enough about the Armenian case study, but, and I didn't go into this in too much depth in the presentation, but the book talks about, I mean, there's a whole chapter on conflict and diaspora's responsibilities for the war. But Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, for instance, went on record during the Truth and Reconciliation process, and she admitted to having funded Charles Taylor, the rebel leader turned president. I think she gave his faction about $10,000. And she did this from the comfort of her home in Washington, D.C. when she worked for the World Bank and the IMF. So people have these sort of tactile experiences of Liberians who've lived abroad and have stoked conflict and war and political upheaval from the comfort of their transnational lives and the comfort of their transnational homes. And so the question is, how do we ensure that this doesn't happen again if we then legislate dual citizenship, we actually give people two passports and they can abscond? You know, they can take money from the treasury, they can, you know, stoke conflict and war and then just escape. So what stops them from doing that? An extradition treaty? We have extradition treaties with the United States, but how did that help us when Charles Taylor escaped to the United States and then came back, went to Libya, got trained, and then wreaked havoc in the country for about, you know, 14 years. So I think it's funny because diasporic Liberians, when I speak to them, they're actually quite angry with me because they say, well, how dare you sit on your high horse in London? Yes, you don't have two passports. You probably don't want two passports, but some of us do. So stop spoiling it for us. And my response is always, we have to think about the fact that people live on the ground. They have to contend with these sorts of political ramifications of our decision-making and our lobbying and our advocacy, and we don't. So that's what I'm concerned about. Those anxieties and sort of angst coming from the ground are what I'm most concerned about, because I have the wherewithal to live here and not to worry about the fact that Liberia is undergoing a serious recession right now. My livelihood doesn't depend on that, but many people, my family members, my friends, my colleagues, former colleagues, it does. So I mean, that tactile experience of diasporas being involved actively in armed conflict and supporting armed conflict and supporting rebel factions is one that we can't escape. This is part and parcel of the conversation and the contestations around dual citizenship that I think are incredibly valid and legitimate in this conversation.
Thanks so much, Roptel. Yeah, we're gonna keep talking.
Yeah.
We have two questions in the chat, so I'm going to go ahead and read those two questions, and then maybe you can answer both at the same time. Sure. So the first is from Samantha, and it says, so she's got a question for you. Could it be argued that the inequality that is being reproduced between dual citizens in Liberia, West Africa in general, is perpetuating cultural colonial modes of inequality in terms of proximity to resource acquisition? And then sort of on the same vein, Helena says, could you speak on your thoughts as to why these seven outliers continue to prohibit dual citizenship, especially on Ethiopia, which has a similar, in quotation marks, non-colonial history as Liberia?
Yeah, so I'll start with the second question because I'm trying to formulate a response to the first question. So one of the, it's all speculation on my part. And I would say maybe this is a third book after the one that I'm working on in the Negro Clause, but what is it about these seven countries? I mean, I definitely go back to Bronwyn Mambi and Mahmoud Mamdani's sort of analysis about the countries that experienced the greatest colonial era migration are the ones that have the most contestations around citizenship. And you can even think about the Eritrea-Ethiopian War, right? So one of the reasons that both Eritrea and Ethiopia do not have dual citizenship laws is because there's rivalry between the two countries. So Ethiopia doesn't want Eritrean Ethiopians to be able to carry two passports, and Eritrea doesn't want Eritrean Ethiopians to be able to carry two passports because there's such visceral, well, I mean, post Abiy Ahmed, there's been some reconciliation between the two countries, but these two countries still have not enacted dual citizenship, and that history is not going to go away. Within the context of countries like DRC, which have been embroiled in all kinds of conflicts and interventions from regional neighbors, there's this fear that you can't have people with multiple passports. Like, that's just going to make things very, very complicated. And then there are countries like, I think Uganda or Tanzania that have had large amounts of refugee inflows from other parts of the region because of instability in the region. So the question is, if we allow these people to reside in our country as refugees, at some point they're going to start claiming citizenship. And that would be really, really difficult for us politically if we start enabling people to have citizenship. So it's a lot of the contestation around not enacting dual citizenship in these seven countries really has to do with migratory flows and the concerns around migratory flows. And then who do we recognize as belonging? Who do we exclude as not belonging? And that's why I like this idea of the political economy of belonging, because it really is about what does it mean for socioeconomic transformation to take place? That it's not just about identity. It's also very, very entrenched in the economics of belonging, right? The economics of inclusion or the economics of exclusion. The first question, Sarah, I think you're gonna have to read it to me once more.
Absolutely. So Samantha asks, could it be argued that the inequality that is being produced between dual citizens in Liberia and West Africa more generally, mm-hmm. perpetuating colonial modes of inequality in terms of proximity to resource acquisition?
Okay, well, I wanna clarify that Liberia doesn't recognize dual citizens. So these people wouldn't be dual citizens, for instance. What's interesting, and I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but what's interesting that came up during the debate amongst the so-called near diasporas and the wider diasporas is this idea of sort of the economic wherewithal to be able to carry two passports. So for instance, those who live in the sub-region, former refugees, because Liberia refugee status was discontinued for Liberians across the globe in 2012 by the UNHCR. So those who have settled in their refugee hosting countries, now the prospect of being able to obtain Ghanaian citizenship or Sierra Leonean citizenship is much more possible. When they did have refugee status, that was impossible because by virtue of having refugee status, the idea of having access to another citizenship is moot, right? So I found that when I was interviewing those Liberians in 2013, this was right after the Refugee Cessation Clause came about, many of them said, well, I'm holding on to my singular citizenship because for the past 14 years living as a refugee in Sierra Leone or Ghana, that's pretty much all I had. That was my lifeline. So the idea of dual citizenship is actually quite difficult for them to wrap their heads around. Whereas Liberians who live in the UK, which does recognize dual citizenship, or the US, which does recognize dual citizenship, and the accessibility to having a second passport or a third passport is more fluid. Those Liberians were more attuned to the prospect of being able to carry their Liberian passport if a dual citizenship legislation is passed and maintaining their UK citizenship or maintaining their UK naturalization citizenship or their US naturalization citizenship. So what I argue throughout the book is that proximity to the challenges of post-war reconstruction, proximity to the challenges of development, as it were, makes those near diasporas very much similar to the perspectives of domestic Liberians who are staunchly opposed to dual citizenship. And I found that to be particularly interesting because of that refugee status as opposed to, you know, not having a refugee status. So the accessibility or lack thereof gives people a certain understanding of what the possibilities are, right? The imagining of what is possible in terms of having more than one citizenship or belonging to more than one country becomes expanded when you leave from that refugee status, which is very, very restrictive in what you can and cannot do or can and cannot obtain in terms of citizenship rights. So I'm not sure it answered your question, but I assume that you were thinking about that dichotomy between the near and the wider diaspora.
Yeah, well, Samantha actually puts in the chat her thank you. So
okay, great.
Start to answer that question. And I think there's some complex relationships going on there that you've really highlighted well. I realize we are in the last, actually, no, we are exactly at 1:30, according to my computer. So thank you so much for your presentation, for your answering to the questions. Thank you for, you know, everyone in the audience who joined us as well. And I just remind the audience once again, if you're interested in hearing more from the III, you know, you can follow the link in the chat function to learn about more upcoming events and to sign up for our fortnightly newsletter. And until we see each other either face-to-face or virtually, have a wonderful day and goodbye.
Thank you, Sarah, for sharing as well. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.